Welcome to episode 64 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I'm a political scientist at UNC Charlotte. And today I'm talking to Tim Gill, who is assistant professor of sociology at UNC Wilmington down the road. He has published on an array of topics, largely involving U.S. global power, Venezuelan politics and human rights, and sociological theory. And he's been published in a number of different journals, including Sociological Forum, Journal of World Systems Research, Social Currents, The American Sociologist, and Third World Quarterly. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Greg.
So, yeah, we last chatted in episode 10, which was in November 2016, not long after Trump's election. I listened briefly to that. It's like, that's a universe ago for Venezuela now.
Yeah.
At that time, the opposition was poking fun at the U.S., saying, oh, hey, have fun with that, with Trump. And so things have changed a bit. I'll put a link to that if you want to re-listen to it, or if anybody else wants to. But for the purposes of this discussion, he co-authored an article with Rebecca Hansen about U.S. policy toward Venezuela in The Nation. And people are up in arms about it. I'll make sure I link to this as well. And specifically, it's about the U.S. government's relationship with Juan Guaido and Guaido himself. So let's just start with, what did you want people to take away from this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we, Becca and I, have quite a few, you know, it's kind of a long piece, so we have a few arguments that we put forth in this Nation article. But, you know, sort of at a broader level, and thinking about U.S. foreign policy, we did, you know, in part write this for a domestic U.S. audience. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, of course, we aren't naive to think that this wasn't going to travel beyond the borders, particularly to Venezuela and elsewhere, you know, to people that are interested in this topic. But yeah, in many ways, it was written for a domestic U.S. audience. I don't think it's controversial to point out that many have taken issue with some of the blunderous U.S. foreign policy activity over the past several decades, from things like Vietnam to the war in Iraq under Bush. And so at a basic level, we did want to draw attention to what the U.S. has been up to in Venezuela, a country that's now on the agenda of Trump, a country where there might be a U.S. Military invasion, and to let people know what the U.S. exactly has been up to. U.S. foreign policy is often very secretive, particularly these sorts of lower level activities, though they're quite consequential as well. And it's our taxpayer dollars that are at work. And so at a general level, you know, it was about bringing this to the attention of the public. You know, as well, more particularly, much of what we're writing about takes place, you know, particularly my research takes place under the Chavez government. I also don't think it's controversial to say that the Chavez government was, you know, in my opinion, nowhere near as authoritarian as the Maduro government. Surely there were flaws. Chavez used state funds for the election. You know, he often denounced journalists and particular NGOs. He, you know, operated in an illiberal manner. But I also think it was quite clear that the population supported him. He went to a recall referendum in 2004. He won numerous presidential elections. Yes, there were some flaws, nothing like what we have seen under Maduro. They were monitored, sometimes internationally monitored. So there was no doubt that the that citizens supported him. Yet at the same time, the U.S. was working on a number of fronts to undermine his rule. Some say undemocratically. You know, we really don't get into that in terms of the 2002 coup. I don't think it's altogether clear what happened then.
Yeah.
Of course, some, you know, some people came out, the IRI, you know, some people in the Bush administration voicing support, but it's not clear if the U.S. was like behind it or anything like this. However, you know, these sorts of activities that we're talking about in the article, USAID, OTI, You know, mostly in this article, we're pointing to their support on the front of civil society, trying to pull citizens away from Chavez, working with these student groups that Guaido was, active during this time period. And so, you know, this is to say nothing. This is only the tip of the iceberg. You know, we didn't say anything about the National Endowment for Democracy and the International Republican Institute, who have particularly worked with political parties and trying to strengthen their activities, groups like Primera Justicia, and others, you know, everything from helping to build their websites to helping them to build their platforms, training seminars for youth, how to reach out to voters, how to talk with journalists. You know, I've written about this elsewhere. So, you know, it's, the U.S. at a time where someone is supported by the citizens, the U.S. was trying to undermine them. So I think it's important that that people know this, that citizens are aware of this. And, this isn't, some people have taken this article to say that we are expressing solidarity with the Maduro government. That's not what we're saying. You know, it's funny, some people even in the Maduro government had retweeted this article. And in it, we level a lot of criticism against the Maduro government. So we're not saying that Maduro is democratic, that we have solidarity with him. One of the other arguments that we make is that, you know, we don't think that the current strategy, particularly taken by the U.S., the oil sanctions are a productive strategy. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this in a bit, but that, you know, we think that there are perhaps some more productive ways that the Venezuelan government can be engaged in order to solve this political economic crisis and ultimately to assist Venezuelan citizens. The sanctions, you know, we don't think, you know, it seems just from previous episodes in places like Iraq and Cuba that these are going to hammer the poor and not necessarily, dismantle the Venezuelan government. So, yeah, I mean, we had a number of, and I can say on Becca's end, what she really wanted to point out with her interviews with Chavistas is that, just because people reject the Maduro government right now, this doesn't mean that it necessarily translates into support for the opposition. And so a political future in Venezuela is going to have to involve Chavismo. Many people still identify with and with Hugo Chavez and Chavismo. His popularity, his favorability ratings remain high. So, there's going to need to be space as well for the Chavistas in the Venezuelan future.
So, why are people so pissed off? Is it that they think you are supporting Maduro? And it's kind of weird too if the Maduro officials close to Maduro think so.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You know, I get the sense a lot of people that retweet. I mean, you probably know this on Twitter. I so often I've seen problems come up too, where somebody retweets an article and thinks it says something or writes something about that article, and it says the opposite, or they make an accusation against somebody, and then it turns into this big kerfuffle. Something like this, I saw something like this happen in sociology recently, that someone retweeted in a public article, they had only read half of it, and so they accused this other sociologist of engaging in something they weren't. I'm trying to keep it vague because I don't even want to enter into this debate.
But I don't know about it, so that's fine.
Yeah. But the point is that sometimes I think people just retweet these articles based on headlines. I think a lot of people, I think that they, as I'm sure you know too, you can't win on Venezuela with some people. If you don't denounce Maduro outright as an evil dictator, that's completely destroying Venezuela and all the rest of it, and is this part of this mafia narco state, and then you're carrying water for the regime and you are a propagandist. And by contrast, if you don't express solidarity with Maduro and say he's truly representing the popular sectors and there's an economic war and it's all because of U.S. imperialism, then you are carrying water for U.S. imperialism. And there's a lot of just, very uncritical black and white sort of thinking that goes, and it's a very polarized context, and I totally understand that people have very strong feelings. I think that some folks, that's how they think, because we didn't just do either of those two things, that they were upset. I think also people, you know, more specifically, they feel that we were perhaps portraying Guaido as sort of a puppet of the U.S. government, even though we say directly in the article that we don't think that you should view Guaido as a puppet. That's not what we were arguing. We were saying that, you know, the student movement developed, the U.S. got behind it, it provided them with resources and amplified their voices. The U.S. has a great deal of, you know, it's the richest country in the world. So it provided them with training, it provided them with resources to amplify their message. This is something the U.S. has done in a number of countries, from, you know, Serbia, Nicaragua. They've done this for a lengthy period of time. So we weren't saying that Guaido was a puppet. We were merely saying that, you know, the U.S. has been on board, you know, with the student movement, with the opposition that he's been a part of for a long time. And so, you know, behind the scenes, there's been a number of people across the political spectrum that have gotten in touch and quibbled with this, that, the other. And I very much, I respect criticism, and I'm, you know, very happy to engage. But I think on Twitter, as I'm sure you know, there's so much posturing that goes on, seemingly for folks' sort of little fan base, their followers. And so, you know, they create, there's so many strawman arguments that were created regarding this article that, you know, that sort of thing, the posturing just to cater to their little fan base. It's very transparent. But, you know, that's fine. If people want to do that, that's fine. I mean, and criticize in that sort of way, it's a very small price to pay for being able to have a public voice on an important issue, which I'm very grateful about. And so, yeah, I think people have a number of motivations, and some of them don't. It doesn't seem like people were reading what they wanted to read in the article.
You know, I need a fan base. I don't have. We all need a fan base. I need somebody to cater to.
Yeah, realize that. Definitely.
Well, so what I thought, or at least one possibility, was people are concerned about the question of causality. And this is something I've actually thought quite a bit about it, because it keeps coming up. So I'm going to quote just a couple of sentences from your article.
Sure. Right?
More than anything else, Guaido appears to be the product of the right-wing, middle-class student movement that developed in opposition to the Chavez government in the mid to late 2000s. This movement, which took to the streets of Caracas to demand the ouster of Chavez, received much of its funding and training from Washington. So I feel like, I don't know if this is like a Rorschach test, but
Sure. Should
we see this as the U.S. creating Guaido? Guaido and others independently looking for help outside Venezuela, or some combination of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the second. I mean, it seems to me that this student movement developed. I mean, students, you know, everywhere, Venezuela, of course, but U.S. have been, you know, always had this kind of streak of involvement in protests. So I think that I wouldn't see this at all, that the U.S. sort of created Guaido, created the student movement. The student movement developed, took to the streets protesting against the closure of RCTV, and or Chavez didn't renew their public license. And so, and then the U.S. jumps on board. You know, there were individuals on the ground, I have to keep this vague as well, that put people from USAID and OTI that the U.S. was in contact with, you know, some individuals in civil society that the U.S., you know, kind of had a relationship with, that put USAID and OTI in touch with the student leaders. And thereafter, the U.S. kind of started backing them, providing them with all sorts of resources. You know, it wasn't just training, wasn't just, you know, some of these materials. They would do things like out west in Maracaibo, they funded a student conference to bring, you know, students from all over the country together so that they could, you know, sort of develop a united front against the Venezuelan government. They would pay for airfare for individuals from abroad to come in to meet with the students and this sort of thing, pay salaries for individuals that were training the student movement. So, yeah, I would see it as, you know, the U.S. comes after and is amplifying, you know, the message and helping them to organize more effectively and all the rest of it. You know, I think there's a quote from one individual from USAID OTI that said wanted to help them, you know, sort of cultivate a long-term movement and ensure that this excitement that developed in the streets didn't just peter out, but was turned into a movement. And, you know, the reality of the situation is many of these individuals that were involved in the student movement at this time are many of the leaders now in the opposition, Stalin Gonzalez, Freddy Guevara, Juan Guaido. So all of these individuals come out of this movement.
Well, but you see what I'm saying is that I think that just taking a statement like that is that Maduro supporters can say, yeah, you know what they're saying is that they're saying that the U.S. created these puppets.
Right.
And then the flip side is like is you saying, oh, you're just not giving these students any agency at all. And, all, you know, so like I feel like that's some of the controversy is this idea that if the U.S. is involved at all, it is somehow directing everything, creating everything, et cetera.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I see how people can think that. I mean, just given the image that's put out there, you know, by the Maduro government and by sort of the uncritical left who sees U.S. imperialism behind everything. I mean, but it's simply not what we are, what we're saying. I mean, yeah. It's just not. But I mean, I very much understand that people would, you know, be willing to draw that conclusion
right.
That's directed by the U.S. But I mean, that's just not the nuanced analysis that we're putting forth. You know, we simply want to draw attention to the fact that the U.S. was funding these students, you know, didn't create them, you know, that they do have their own agency. I mean, these are, you know, individuals that do have serious grievances with the socialist government. But, you know, it's not a, you know, I don't get the sense that the U.S., I mean, if you look through many of the documents, you know, there are plenty of times when student groups, when the opposition defies what the U.S. advocates for them. So, you know, abstention from participation in elections. I mean, you can see this in the WikiLeaks cables, you know, U.S. diplomats, U.S. Members of the U.S., you know, State Department are urging the opposition to continually participate in elections, and they don't. And so it's not always the case that, you know, that people on the ground, students, political parties are just listening to what the U.S. has to say and then going from there. So, I totally get that where people are coming from, but, you know, that's not the argument that, you know, that we made. So I don't feel, you know, I don't feel responsible for that,
right,
for people, you know, taking that line. I think it's a straw man, perhaps, to discredit, you know, what it is that we are saying. But, you know, I understand people's position.
So along similar lines, one of the things that you two note is that, you know, people are, like you said, they still have a support for Chavismo, just generally speaking, and they may or may not really like the way that someone like Guaido would govern. Does the relationship with the U.S. give us any sense of how he would govern, or does that matter?
I mean, I think certainly in terms of foreign policy, I think that we, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, I think that, you know, clearly we get the sense that Guaido would prioritize relations with countries in Western Europe, like-minded country, or at least, you know, these centrist parties and leaders that have come to power in Latin America. As well as the U.S. I mean, I don't think it's entirely clear how Guaido would manage relations with places like China, Russia, Iran. My guess is that, you know, at least politically and sort of ideologically, these relationships wouldn't be prioritized. But I know that Guaido is trying to reach out to China, to a certain extent, trying to reach out to Russia. But it seems to me that what Guaido, and he's even said this, would prioritize is more sort of private investment, perhaps reversing some of the expropriations of factories and all sorts of industries, supermarkets, you name it, and so forth. So, I mean, I think it gives us some sense of how we would govern, particularly with regards to foreign policy. And we have some indication of, you know, some of his plans on the domestic scene economically. But I don't think we have the complete picture of precisely how he would govern.
Okay. And I don't know whether this question fits as well here. Maybe it would actually fit earlier a little bit more, but they so Venezuelans know Leopoldo López, obviously, and you write that, quote, most Venezuelans may not be aware of the ties between Guaido's party and the United States. You had there was a connection to Leopoldo López. Maybe I'm getting the wrong quote.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But so I was under the impression that all of this, the ties to López, ties to U.S., was more common knowledge. Is that wrong?
Well, so this comes out of, this sentence is derived from sort of Becca's work with Chavistas that she talked to about Juan Guaido. And so, yeah, I think that the point there and her sort of impression from the interviews with Chavistas was that, this is tangled up with the fact that Guaido is just simply, people didn't know who he was. And the fact that people didn't know who he was, that, these connections between him and López and the U.S. wasn't something that really turned up in conversations with individuals. So it's sort of tied up with, all of that Guaido sort of comes out of nowhere, and that individual, many everyday Venezuelans may not be making this leap from Guaido to López to the U.S.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that which was then it could mean for some people a rude awakening, potentially.
Right. Right.
Because what benefits him tremendously is that he's got no baggage, that he's a blank slate for people.
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So let me switch gears a little bit in trying to sort out the current situation and where we're heading. You advocate for dialogue. And is there a realistic route to that could create a peaceful transition that everyone is at least mostly happy with?
I mean, I certainly hope so. I mean, it is hard to see it right now, as both sides, only want to agree to particular terms. I mean, Guaido only wants to get the usurper out of power and has said, the time for dialogue is over. People in the U.S., Bolton and Pompeo have also said things like this, that the time for dialogue, time for negotiations is over. It's time for Maduro to leave. It's time for the military to side with democracy. So there's multiple, options on the table. There's this European EU contact group with some EU countries and some Latin American countries. They want to, last I have seen, they have some preconditions about having a new electoral authority, the acceptance of humanitarian aid, as well as agreeing to having a presidential election. And that doesn't seem, it's hard for me to see. I was just looking at the interview yesterday that Maduro, I'm sure you saw this very interesting interview that with BBC. He doesn't seem at all willing, you don't get the impression from that interview or anything that's going on that he's going to simply outright agree to a new presidential election before he goes to negotiations. I mean, it seems more likely to me that something like, the mechanism that has been pushed by Uruguay and Mexico, where they could sit down without any sort of preconditions. That seems to me more plausible, that perhaps the opposition could be convinced, to sit down for something like that. I'm sure some would disagree. Guaido, of course, is putting out that he disagrees. But, I think that at this point, I very much understand the opposition perspective of how the negotiations have all broken down over the last, 5 years with the government, and the government hasn't negotiated in earnest and abided by what it said it would and all the rest of it. I think it, Maduro's back is against the wall. I think that's very obvious. I think it's obvious to people that have followed Venezuelan politics for a long time. I mean, at any other point in time, Guaido would be in jail. He would be imprisoned. I mean, he's saying that he's the president, the fact that, of course, there's been some freezing of bank accounts, but the fact that, the Venezuelan government has not seriously legally pursued him yet, I think is very indicative of the fact that Maduro is scared. So, given You know, so I mean, given all of that, I could see it seems possible that perhaps the government would make some serious concessions on their terms, you know, with optics that are favorable to them rather mm-hmm. than saying, you know, okay, yeah, we agree to these preconditions. Sure, we're going to have an election and sure, we're going to have a new electoral authority. That doesn't seem realistic to me at this point. But, you know, I'm sure to many, dialogue without preconditions doesn't seem realistic. I very much hope one of the two works out, because the alternative, I think, you know, just as Beck and I wrote, you know, just sort of pushes Venezuela closer to a more violent situation.
Yeah, and so that's my last question, and a real concern of mine is that, do you think the Trump administration will let this drag out, or, you know, it's put so much, used so much political capital, or is will it just say, screw it, we're going to invade?
I mean, yeah, it's very hard to predict, especially with Trump in power and...
Bolton likes invading countries.
Exactly. And Trump has said before, you know, why can't we just invade, you know, Venezuela, to the horror of people like Rex Tillerson and others, many of whom are gone now. And so so that's a possibility. I do not think that's out of the realm of possibility. You know, I think a lot of what Trump is doing with regards to Venezuela is for a domestic audience here in the U.S. You know, it seems there's some in the, you know, just the State of the Union talking about socialism. There are whispers that he's planning to have to run against Bernie Sanders, and, you know, that he's going to run against socialism. And so this, you know, Venezuela, of course, is all tangled up with this. And so, I mean, I'm sure that there is, I would think that there's a red line. And I'm sure that there are people behind the scenes that are pushing for U.S. military intervention. What that red line is, Bolton and others have said, you know, if the Venezuelan government goes after Guaido and his allies, or anything happens with, you know, U.S. diplomatic personnel, that there is going to be serious consequences. It's possible that something like that becomes a red line, you know, as Guaido goes to get humanitarian aid across the border. If, you know, he is arrested, it's possible that Trump, I mean, you know, that there is this sort of red line that is put on the table. I don't think that, you know, some have suggested that maybe Venezuela will fall off the table and just not be of interest as North Korea and Iran and the border and other issues come up. I don't think it's going to fall off the table.
It's not. Pompeo, you know, yeah. Bolton, Marco Rubio, they're heavily invested in it in a way that nobody is in North Korea.
Right. Right, exactly. So there's no way it's going to fall off the table. I mean, so in the short term, it seems like the strategy is, you know, try to pull the military away, impose these economic sanctions, and see if, you know, see if that works. I don't really see that working. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there will probably be some strategies on the part of Guaido, perhaps to design, perhaps with members of the international community, to bait, you know, to have these sort of high profile events. I mean, what's going on the border right now with USAID and bringing humanitarian aid across the border does seem designed for optics. So I would expect more events like this and some further escalation perhaps between Maduro and Guaido. And then I imagine that the U.S. will probably establish some sort of red line at some point. And then who knows, you know.
Yep. All right. With that, though, we are out of time. I've been talking to Tim Gill, assistant professor of sociology at UNC Wilmington. Catch him on Twitter. I'm going to link to the article that we've been discussing. So you can all check it out yourself or misinterpret it however you want and then post it on Twitter. Tim, thank you again.
Thank you, Greg. Really appreciate it.